Hey folks, Heather Cox Richardson and Joanne Freeman here. Thank you for being members of the Cafe Insider community.
This is Backstage, a special segment of the Now and Then podcast exclusively for you. We hope you enjoy it. So Heather, as we were having this conversation, and as we were preparing for this episode, some of these people who we were talking about, above and beyond the way that they're interesting in our conversation right now, they're just interesting. And you get sort of sucked into their story. I mean, why was I going off looking at Caesar's columns? You know, I mean, I didn't really need to do that for this episode, but I became curious. And then if I had had time, I would have, you know, gone falling down some rabbit hole reading more about him. And it made me think about, as a historian, the many times in which I've been studying or analyzing or collecting the writings of or reading about a particular character who in one way or another is problematic or not necessarily entirely praiseworthy, maybe eccentric. And the ways in which I get pulled into that kind of an orbit and I enjoy it, and in a sense, I feel like I'm getting pulled along on what brought them to power in the first place. Do you ever have that sense that you get kind of sucked into the orbit of some of the people who you study?
I'm laughing because, yes. I mean, there is the love of doing what both of us do when we look at, you know, the way the Congress works or the way the government works. And to me, that's this giant game of Sudoku. You know, if this person does this, then what happens to the price of the sugar tariff in 1857? And, you know, and I love that. It's a very intellectual, you know, chess game, which I really love. But when I was in graduate school, I read my way through every sort of out. That's how I knew Ignatius Donnelly. I read all of his books. I read everything Madame Blavatsky wrote. I had them all in my carol, because in a way you get mesmerized by these people who are not in the mainstream. Like, there's the puzzle of the tariff, but there is this fascination with people who are not acting in the same way that the rest of us are.
And if they're not quite following along with the flow, they have to be more explicit and more direct and bolder in what they're saying, right? Because they're veering off in a different direction. They have to find a way to share that vision. And maybe that's also part of why you had all those books in your carol.
Well, and even more than that, when I think about them and I think about Ignatius Donnelly and the stuff he wrote and many of the other things I read at the same time and still do, I think of them in color. Like, you just never know what's going to happen next. You almost can't look away. And, you know, when I think about reading the Congressional Record, which I actually enjoy doing, I never think of the Congressional Record in color. You know, it's always in black and white. And
oh, I do.
and yet, you know, you think about what interests me about that is that I've never really put it together with the modern day attraction for the more eccentric candidates. And I've heard people say about the former President Donald Trump that you couldn't look away, that he happened on stage. So you had to watch to see what was going to happen next. And I had never put that together with the attraction of these more eccentric characters in American history.
Right. And I guess I don't necessarily think this way with former President Trump, but one of the things that I'm always intrigued with when I'm doing the kind of history that I do is figuring out the internal logic of how some of these extreme or eccentric people, how did they get to where they ended up? What's the process? What's the logic and the thought? What's the life experience and the emotion and the motive and all of the things that add up to someone moving in a particular direction? I love to reconstruct that kind of thing. But once you've done that for someone, you feel in a certain way that you understand them, and you end up, I think, just as you're suggesting, you end up sort of watching and thinking about what they're doing, understanding why they're doing it. And personally, you know, I've written so much about violent, angry men. So much of my career has been writing about angry, violent men. When I figure out why they're doing what they're doing, there's, as a historian, there's satisfaction in that. It's a level of political understanding that's kind of seductive. I don't know, you get sort of pulled into different visions, even if you don't like the vision itself. I don't appreciate or approve of anything that my particularly violent, angry Southern slavery defenders believed. But I was so intrigued with the violence that they're using to push their cause, like how they reasoned their way into it and what kind of logic did they use and how did they decide that was okay? And how did they deal with it as individuals? I get kind of wrapped up in the sort of personal component of that story. And I felt kind of guilty the whole time I was writing that book because I was intrigued, in my case, with people who I actually think were bad and wrong. In your case, you're talking about really interesting people who just have a different vision.
Well, no. I mean, you know, the first two characters like that I was involved with were Donnelly and Long, one of whom became a dictator and one of whom would have become a dictator if he could have. And the first people he would have gone after were all the Jews, you know. So, but one of the things that I think about them is, and one of the reasons I think it was probably a good thing that I went into politics through literature, is the empathy that it creates to look at a fictionalized character in the book that I read as a young woman, a girl. I wasn't a woman. I wasn't even 10, I don't think, but that they really were people. And that's one of the things I think that makes history so important. And if done right, so interesting, is that if you know the outcome ahead of time, why read the book, as it were? You know, if you know how history is going to play out, we don't need to know that story because it's like watching a movie. You know, if you already know what the end is, who's going to watch the end of the movie? But when you truly understand how much of our history is, I can't believe I'm saying this to you, contingent, and that it really can, you know, that there really are forces in tension and they really often could go either way, that then becomes an epic story. You know, the war could go either way. The future could go either way. We could save democracy or we could lose democracy. And that is an epic story in a way that, oh yeah, of course we know it's going to come out, isn't.
An epic story, but you used a word that I want to go back to, and that is empathy. An epic story that in one way or another is grounded on some empathy or understanding or willingness to reach out to people in the past and confront them as people, regardless of what you think about them. So you're right. I mean, in a sense, that's how you get history being an epic tale without it being a bunch of myths, is it's a story, I'll use my contingent word again. You know, it's a contingent story. We don't know what's going to happen, even if we think we know what's going to happen. Yes, there's going to be a civil war. If you're really looking at history, you don't know how it gets there. And historians all the time are finding ways to get at the logic of events in ways that haven't been shown before. But in one way or another, I think if you don't touch on the human component of the stories that we're telling, and that's true for any kind of eccentric individual, any kind of sort of outstander, and all of the conventional people that are potentially less interesting, you have to be in touch with that human component to understand the logic of their politics, and more important than that, particularly in the realm of politics, why they were appealing, why people followed them.
Why they were appealing, I think, and I just want to clarify that when I say empathy, I don't mean sympathy. I mean, yeah.
No. I mean connecting with their humanness.
Right, because part of being able to say Huey Long came from this kind of a background, he recognized the lack of schooling and the lack of roads and all that, I still make moral judgment. You can understand somebody and still not like, you know, still not approve of what they're doing. And I think that's a really important line, just that people understand when we say empathy, we don't mean, you know, anything goes. Ignatius Donnelly is not my friend.
No, but it's being able to confront the fact that they were people.
And not cardboard cutouts.
Exactly. And thus able to figure out how they came up with their really bad ideas that you oppose. But their humanness matters a lot in the understanding of history. And I think sometimes that can be an easy thing to overlook. And I don't think you can fully understand any political story unless you have that component built in. And Newby is
completely in agreement.
Chirping and singing. He is. I don't know if you can hear him, but I can hear him.
Well, one of the things that I always tell people interested in history about understanding how things happen is that while there are always exceptions, most people do not wake up in the morning and put their feet in the ground and say, I'm going to go out in the world today and be a complete, you know, rat bastard. they put their feet on the ground and say, I'm going to save.
There are some, though.
There are some. But, you know, most people put their feet on the ground and say, I'm going to save the country, or I'm going to feed my family, or I'm going to protect my church, or whatever. And they go out and they do things that sometimes we approve of, but that sometimes we find heinous. And it's important to understand that they're not cardboard cutouts, because then we could see them before they do it. You know, if they, right. if everybody had a sign saying, you know, I'm a Nazi, you would be able to recognize that. It's much harder when they say, I'm your really cute 77-year-old neighbor out here planting crocuses. And I happen to be a Nazi.
Right.
And I happen to be a Nazi as well.
Yeah,
that's right.
The how is a huge part of the history. You know, the how is a large part of what you and I spend a lot of time digging up. And sometimes exploring that does give you a sense of the appeal of things in the past that actually we don't find appealing at all. But I think that's one of the underlying stories of what we talked about today is, in one way or another, we kept talking about storytellers, and the power that they have is the power to appeal to people. It's the very same thing we're talking about. And they are able to appeal in a way that pulls people into their orbit because they're able to present some sort of vision, either of who they are or what they want to do or what they want the world to be like, that sells to the public.
And in an ideal democracy, the public can then test the words against the reality and dismiss those people who are not living up to the words. And what we're concerned about is that we are losing the ability to do that.
Precisely. That all of that testing and speaking and extreme ideas or eccentric ideas, it all is grounded on free and fair elections and the democratic process in one way or another. And if that begins to be eroded, the meaning of having those sorts of people in power can change dramatically. Thank you for joining us backstage.
Be sure to write to us with your thoughts and questions at letters@cafe.com.
See you next time.